Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, presenting Richard Moss, Broken Specter, a photography exhibition focusing on the devastation of the Amazon rainforest, November 15th to February 16th. Support for WPR comes from Becca Kate's Kitchen, Kids and Home in downtown Baraboo, offering gourmet cookware, specialty gadgets, and bridal registry. More at BEKAHKates.com.
That's music composed by Bill Banfield, award-winning American composer and cultural studies activist. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Today, we have a rare opportunity to explore the background and sample the wide range of musical works by an acclaimed composer. Composer in residence with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra from 2021 to 2024, Bill Banfield is championing a project to celebrate and record the works of other Black composers and to involve the community in the process. He is the composer of over 200 original works, including symphonies, operas, concerti, choral works, big band scores, chamber concert works, and popular and jazz songs. Bill Banfield, welcome to University of the Air.
Oh, so good to be here with you. How are you today?
I'm good, and I'm honored to have you on the show. Oh. I just, it's really rare to talk to a composer that's still actively composing and has this whole body of work out there and also has been an author of books and a champion of cultural studies and bringing to light some neglected works and figures from history as well. So I'm looking forward to sampling your work and some of the ideas and influences that have motivated you. I wonder if we could start way back, you know, because you were born in Detroit.
Yeah.
Can you tell me something about your early years, your family background, and what would, if you look back at that now, what set the stage for your becoming a composer?
Well, I have to say, the city I'm from, Detroit, which is a great American city, and the environment we had in those days, education and culture, music and church and education and neighborhoods and my parents, you know, they really instilled that in us about the value of these things. And I went to a Detroit high school called Cass Tech. And actually my dad, who's 99 years old, pushing 100, graduated in aeronautical design right before World War II and went away and did his thing. And I went to that same high school because it was the number one public high school in the country, Detroit Cass Tech, and it had the number one music program. So people like Ron Carter and you know, all kinds of people, Regina Carter, or there was any number of great musicians who were my generation but earlier who were there. And so we have this city. We have parents who are engaging us in going to the church choir and the gospel choir, but we had Motown and the symphony and the ballet, blah, blah, blah. And the thing I remember directly to your question is our freshman music history teacher, and his name was Dr. Glenn, and we are in music history at ninth grade. I don't know what age you are, and then 15, 14, whatever. And the number one song, and now this is going to really take us back to the date specific. You talk about ancient history. The number one song at that time was Lionel Richie, or not Lionel Richie, hadn't become Lionel Richie yet. He was in the Commodores. He's the lead singer for the Commodores. The tune was Three Times a Lady, you know? And he said in a music history class, it was going to be looking at everything from Bach to Beethoven to maybe we would get to Bernstein, right? But he said, I want you to listen to this song and let's talk about it. And there were three long verses. Obviously, you're once, twice, three times a lady. And the way in which the song built around the lyrics and the production and the harmonies and the rhythms and and when the group comes in and they sing in unison, they have this big choral thing. And he said, I want you to listen to the music construction. I want you to listen to the orchestration and the arrangement. I want you to listen to the artistry, and I want you to listen to the words and what they say, how the poetry is laid out, and how the poetry and the song structure fit together. Well, that's musicology, ethnomusicology, sociology. It's theory. It's construction of a structure. It's composition, orchestra, all that in that one thing. And this was a music history class where he embraced the popular culture of the time. And for us that are in cultural studies, that's what it's about. You look at the cultural context you live in, you look at that, and that becomes your beginning point, your end point, and perhaps your future point as you move the culture forward. So in that one instance, it gave me everything I needed to understand what eventually became the thing I wanted to grow up doing, which is writing music and being aware of the culture we're in and being aware of the social cultural context. So to answer your question, that was something that was really important to me and gave me a roadmap for how I was going to step out.
It also seems to point to where you would land with this kind of in-between with classical music and popular music, where you're embracing the overlap, the commonality between different genres. I'm curious, too, like if you're on an airplane and you're traveling and someone sitting next to you says, what do? And you say you're a composer, how do you define yourself?
Usually they notice I'm a composer because I'm conducting music in the air or I have a score. Like I'm on my way here to WCO, to Madison, and I'm looking over my scores or writing, you know, and they notice that I'm writing music. And I'm not doing it to be pretentious. That's just what I do. I can't, if I'm on the plane, I'm reading, you know, or doing what everybody else is doing, sleeping or relaxing or reading an article or something. But if I'm doing work, it's not on my computer looking at, you know, some stats from something. It is writing music. I'm a composer. That's what I do, right? So they say, oh, that's, I saw, no, my kid wants to be in a band, or I like this, or I like that. I notice you're writing music, or you're looking at a score. That's when I get to say, yeah, we actually write the tones. We have the rhythms, da-da-da-da, that's both a tone and a rhythm, and it has a harmony. And I don't have to get into any kind of technical thing, but they get that people who do music, we actually create something in our mind and it goes to pen or pencil or paper and then that's distributed to musicians. Then the discussion comes about what kinds of music do you listen to as a composer? And I generally just like the discussion you and I are having. I say, well, all great music is just great music. It's a great tune. It's a love song or it's a jazz song or it's a hip hop song or a pop song or a country song, whatever. But music is very important. And then we're able to talk about how music really is an important part of people's lives.
And when did you decide that composing was what you were going to do? I think I saw on your background that you have a theology degree as well as music degrees and so on. And when did you sort of narrow it into, I am a composer and this is what I'm going to do?
Well, I know my mom would say that it was her. I'm sure she's in heaven now, but she would say that that when she was a kid, the big hero at the time, and my mother's born in the 1920s, you know, was Duke Ellington, and Duke Ellington was this huge popular figure, but he was America's greatest composer. You can talk about Bernstein or Copland or, you know, Amy Beach, all these other people. But Ellington was the one who got projected as the icon of popular culture and class and what have you. And my mother would always tell me that when her older brothers took her to see a Duke Ellington concert, Duke Ellington came out and saw her and came up to her and said, what would you like to hear this evening, little lady? And she always talks about that experience. So she was doing that, and my parents loved classical music, but they also loved jazz and the popular music. So they were always talking about composers write music. If you're going to do music, you can play the guitar all you want, but you got to write some music and blah, blah, blah. So I grew up wanting to be like Duke Ellington and Johannes Brahms and Jimi Hendrix at the same time. That's where I got all mixed up. Yeah, because the cultural hero of my day was Jimi Hendrix. I thought, oh, it was really cool. I wanted to play guitar. Mm-hmm. But Jimi Hendrix was an innovator. as a songwriter and the electronics that he did with his guitar. So I kind of got all those things mixed up. The composition was electronics and songwriting and being cool with the guitar and writing with an orchestra. So those things really impacted my idea of the definition of what a composer was.
I wonder if we could listen to a part of a piece that you've written where it shows the Duke Ellington influence.
Sure. We'll listen to that. I mean, there's so many of them. I mean, one of these is from my big band, and I think that will show, and it's called the Imagine Orchestra. And there's a CD out with my Imagine Orchestra on the Jazz Urbane label, and you can hear the influences, I think, with the Imagine Orchestra and the things I'll play for you that you're hearing, and you can hear all that. You can hear the Duke Ellington influence, but you can also hear the influence of Stravinsky and the influence of Ravel and the influence of another really important composer, who is Leonard Bernstein, who's a huge hero of mine. And I was able to meet with him and hang out with him, and he gave me very important instructions about how he envisioned American music and how I might bring all those things together. I mean, that was the thing, to have Leonard Bernstein sit down with you and say, I like what you're doing and what you're thinking about, but do it this way, do it your way, because that's the way I did. I did it my way, you do it your way. And the cross-sections of American popular music, orchestral music, and the popular music that influenced me as a young person growing up in the 60s and 70s and 80s, listening to all that music, I put all that in my music. And you can hear vestiges of all those things and the things we're playing today.
From Joe's Blues by my guest, Bill Banfield. You know, Langston Hughes wrote in his first book of jazz, it was not until the blues, ragtime, and jazz came along that America had a music we could call our very own to play and sing. When you hear that composition of your own, Joe's Blues, what jumps out at you as sort of this original American music that no other country can do, because it's got
blues.
All these, yeah.
It's the blues.
So tell me about the
blues.
The blues
is the quintessential mother song, mother tongue of American music. Everybody that heard it in the 19th century said, oh my goodness, that's American music. It wasn't anything else, because everything else that the Americans were doing were copying the Europeans. And so someone like Dvorak, in 1893, Dvorak said the future music of this country must be founded upon your original peoples. That would be Native American people and the African tradition of the blues, or the American tradition of the blues. So that's the only thing that's truly born on American soil. All the other musics were brought from all the other folks that came. And those different groups mixed those musics over time. But if at that time, when America was championing that it was the land of the free, well, you have to deal with the freest music. And the freest music was the blues. It was the music that a person could sing about their personal experiences and simultaneously create a structure and improvise on that structure, but improvise cohesively from the materials that were in the tune. Nobody else does that, except for you could hear an Irish jig song, you know, and you can hear the song, the folk song, and hear the violinists actually replicating the melodies. But the tradition that made that the top aesthetic performance criteria was blues and jazz. That's an American phenomenon. And that's why we pay such attention to blues. And then all the great singers in the 1920s, I mean, the jazz age, come on, mm-hmm. top of the century, they were all wanting to do the blues and jazz. And so by the 1920s, when radio and, you know, bluegrass and stuff started being broadcast, it was our vernacular forms, which were both, you know, bluegrass, country music, vernacular music, and which we call the American roots music. And blues is one of those foundational American roots musics.
You also have spirituals, you know, whether it's Go Down Moses or Joshua at the Battle of Jericho or whatever, where it's got some of those elements of blues, but more of the speaking for the community.
Well, interesting you say that. The blues takes its elements from the spirituals, like you say. So the blues is emulating the spirituals. And, you know, there are some people in popular culture that say the only thing, the difference between, you know, the spirituals and the blues and R&B is just the religious component. You just call your savior the blues, or you call your savior, you know, your God or your spirit. But the musical language is all the same. It's all that African griot music that then got put into the spirituals, which turned into the spirituals, and then the spirituals turned into blues, and then blues turned into, you know, jazz and reggae, and then gospel, and then we move on to the 1930s, 1940s, and we get into, you know, R&B and popular music and rock and roll, and it just keeps evolving and evolving. But the true root of that is this, what Cornel West calls the spiritual blues impulse. It's both got, like you say, that common community base. And every American and every body that was looking at American music could feel that, because you got Russian notion of spirituality, you got, you know, you got a Jewish notion of spirituality, you have, you know, Germans and Italians. All of those folk peoples have folk songs. And so the blues became the American folk song. So everybody understood that. And it had a rhythmic kind of, you know, kind of propulsion on it that was like American. America was like this fast nation that was moving towards its own borders of freedom and equality and blah, blah, blah. So the blues music was the music that best fit that kind of national notion of ourselves. And so blues is very, very, you know, critical to that identity.
When Langston Hughes came out with his Weary Blues in 1926, he got criticism, too, that it was not serious enough, that it wasn't elevated enough. You know, the vernacular, sometimes those who compose either music or literature featuring the vernacular sometimes have to defend that.
Yeah.
You know, that it's as serious as a Beethoven or a Brahms.
Well, yeah, you bring up a very interesting thing. Dvorak would have said that that was the serious music. But then remember, Dvorak wrote his great symphony, you know, Symphony for the New World. But it was based on those vernacular pieces. Beethoven started his symphony with peasant songs, the people's songs first. All of the Puccini, all of the operas are based on common people's songs. So if somebody like Ellington would say, Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston and, you know, all these folks, they would say, but the brilliance, the genius of the folk song is that is the natural beat, heartbeat, and meaning of the people. And it's the artist's job, who he or she is supposed to elevate that. So that's the role of the artist, to take those folk vernacular materials and turn them into even more expanded art. There's nothing that dilutes the original. It only elevates it. So we have something that we can all sing and dance to. And that's what Beethoven and Mozart and Stravinsky and Ellington and, you know, Mary Lou Williams, that's what they're all doing. They're taking the basic folk propulsion music and elevating a little bit by putting it into a song or a dance step or a symphony or a pop song or a rock and roll song or a jazz chart. That's what we're supposed to do. The problem is in education, when we get to the levels where we put down the common people and their issues and the way in which they do their rituals. No, we have to celebrate those. And the way in which we as artists are trained is to take those elements, like Lionel Richie or the Commodores Three Times the Lady, and understand it is both a common song, but the elegance and the beauty of singing about a person being three times as wonderful as they are. What a marvelous equation for equality and beauty that is. And popular song and music in the arts, whether it's poetry or dance or sculpture, that's why we look at those art forms so, hold them so high, because they can take the very common elements and make them palatable for everyone.
I know one other thing you've done throughout your career is to take the words and the lives of key figures in African-American history, like Frederick Douglass or Edmonia Lewis or other figures that we may know or not know and give them a musical context. Mm. And we're going to sample some of that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. One of the last grand Renaissance men in our time, a towering artist, exemplary educator, rigorous scholar, courageous freedom fighter, and spiritual genius. Those are the words of Dr. Cornel West about my guest, composer Bill Banfield. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with University of the Air, and we are celebrating the composer ring of Bill Banfield. That's a title you gave, I think, to one of your albums, right? Composer ring?
Composer ring, but it comes out of the thing we're very much talking about, Emily, which is, you know, people want to know, what does a composer do? So I said, composering. What does that mean? It's the activities around being a composer. That means writing the music, but also means writing about the music. It means teaching about the music. It means coaching about the music. It means understanding the music. It means doing the hustle that musicians have to do, particularly composers, to get your music played. I call it all pedagogically and philosophically and work ability composering.
One of the things that strikes me about a composer, and I sat at a table with you at concerts on the square and saw a premiere of one of your works as well as some other pieces being performed, and thought about the fact that when you compose something and then release it to an orchestra that's going to compose it, that's going to perform it, it's out of your hands.
Yeah.
And there were, I think, one work where you hadn't actually heard it performed yet, and then it's in the hands of the conductor and the instruments and the weather and everything else. But it must be such a magical, maybe also sometimes frustrating, feeling to have a work you've composed and then hear how it's being interpreted and performed by others.
Yeah, I think that's what makes the work with Andrew Sewell really, really triumphant here. We talked about Leonard Bernstein, and Leonard Bernstein coached both Andrew and myself when we were younger. We were in our 20s then, and we won't say what age we are now, but we met when we hung out with Leonard Bernstein. So when you have a conductor, they can interpret your work because they know you. You know, you can't ask Beethoven or Stravinsky or somebody, what did you want here? Well, Stravinsky would write about it. Beethoven kind of wrote about it. He and Mozart wrote about it. But when you can talk to the composer, which is why to do the works of living composers is so important, and I'm not standing on my pulpit about it, American orchestras need to do living composers. Why are we spending time doing all those people who are gone away? But the angst that you talk about is lessened when you work with an orchestra like the WCO, who has a music director like Andrew Sewell, who understands contemporary music and understands the history, so he can bring it all together. So you feel, by me being composer in residence, I'm a little less anxious because I know the musicians. See, when I write a bassoon line now, guess what?
You know who's playing.
I know who's playing in his orchestra. When I'm writing a horn line, and the horn players the other day, we were having a conversation, they were talking to me about how I should voice the horns for this orchestra. When I go to do my music, when I'm writing music for WCO, I can make those specific detail changes because I talk to the musicians who play the music. That's the advantage of having live composers. They're writing for the times that we live in and for the people who play the music. That's the way it should be.
So it's a real collaboration.
It is collaboration.
And I know you're also reaching out to the community.
And it's community-based. Yeah. Right. I think to your question, that's what takes the angst off of it. Now, when you hear it, you know that you're hearing it because a conductor cared about the music, cared about the players. And me as a composer, I'm writing actually for the time and the city I live in and for the musicians who play the music. That's very important.
On your website, you have excerpts from symphonies, from chamber works, from popular songs, from operas, which we'll get to in a bit, but all different kinds of music. I was wondering if we could hear the piece Sunday and talk about that one.
Special things.
Sunday is the text by a woman whose name is Carolyn Mitchell. She is a professor of English at Indiana University. And she talked about being a child, growing up, living in, I can't remember where she was living, but New York in the 1950s. And as the case with a lot of families, you'd send your kids to the summer to go be with relatives. And her relatives were from the South. And so she talked about what happened every day, Monday, Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, going to church, the country fried chicken, the baskets of berries and biscuits that the neighbors would have. All those experiences were different than the experiences she had in New York, which is subways and billboards, whatever was going on in the 1950s. And she wrote this poem about the each day, and that soon was about Sunday. You know, how everybody dressed, what the preacher said, what the choir sang. And so you hear choir in that, you know, and what granddad talked about and all these kinds of things. So I think that the thing that you're having us to talk about is, again, back to vernacular culture, mm-hmm. and poetry and the stories of common people, and how then we elevate that or bring illumination to that narrative in the music. That's what music is. This is a great song by Samuel Barber, Knoxville, you know, 1940, I can't remember. Not everybody who knows music constantly will beat me up for forgetting the date. But it's Knoxville, 1914, I think, or 1917. 1914, I think. I love this tune. I can't remember the date now. But it's about poetry. And when you hear Samuel Barber's tune, you understand it's about the stories of people. And it's a lovely, you know, incredible American concert work. But I think that's the model. And I think I'm glad you picked that, because that piece to me speaks to Carolyn Mitchell's story. But it's also an American story about how people go back and forth to visit their relatives and what that experience is about.
I know a lot of Black artists are frustrated by the tendency to talk about, you know, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech for a little bit, and Rosa Parks, a few other things, and you call it Black History Month, and then you're done with it. And that there are so many works and ideas and themes and figures that get left out of the story. What are some examples you can give me of where in your own work you have felt a kind of drive to bring into the limelight the forgotten or the marginalized or the sort of overlooked, the ones that don't get the credit that they deserved?
Well, I think these stories that you talk about, that we talked about, like in the narrative of this Sunday, Monday, Tuesday narrative, mm-hmm. of just common people. We talked about the blues. But if you talked about historical figures, they're at least, my dissertation was on the works of Martin King and Malcolm X. These two figures who, you know, they're icons now, but we only think of them in very specific and sometimes marginalized and limited ways. Martin Luther King was just I Have a Dream speech, and we see the pictures of the 1960s and what have you. But Martin Luther King was like a social philosopher that studied Gandhi and studied. I mean, he was such a genius. His writing is incredible, okay?
Right.
Forget all the other stuff. Just his writing is so beautiful in depth because he studied so many different philosophers and what have you. But I think that what we want to do, what I try to do that piece is to show also Malcolm X's incredible wide view of the world. And he changes, he evolved. We see him on this radical part, but his notion of embracing humanity and community and progressive thoughts for this nation were things that we would we already embrace today. We just don't give him credit for saying it. And also Martin King. So those were figures that I did. I wanted to bring greater emphasis to the way in which their philosophies were similar and different, and that's what made the music sound that way. Two other figures were the Paul Robeson. My Symphony 8 is based on the works of Paul Robeson from his book Here I Stand, where he talked about his philosophy of American culture moving forward. You know, I mean, and something we could all embrace. So I think that's the role of an artist, is to illuminate the path as well and to bring those figures. And then, of course, you talked about opera, and we'll talk about that. My a current opera is Edmonia, and it's being premiered in various places around the country, and it looks at Edmonia Lewis, the 19th century sculptress who was leading the way for American women, American sculptors in general, and all of Europe embraced her before we did. I mean, this is the 1860s and 70s. This Native American black woman who was being championed through Europe as the genius from America. Why don't we know about Edmonia Lewis? We have a stamp now, thank God, the Edmonia Lewis stamp. So people are starting to hear about Edmonia Lewis. But my opera is based on her life, and her works are now in the Smithsonian. So here's a way for us to look at not only a great artist, because she's looking at freedom of expression, but she was also looking at how a woman could actually do great sculptress at that time when that wasn't something that was championed or encouraged. So the workspace we can talk about, the ability for her to find her voice and to use her identity in her voice to speak her art. And so we value that today. So we have to bring up these examples. It's great for education. Mm-hmm. It's another thing that's very important with arts. It's arts and education.
Well, I always find myself feeling embarrassed by what I wasn't exposed to.
Yeah.
You know, I got a PhD in English literature and went through the school system and everything else all the way up to a PhD. And at that time, I had never heard of Frederick Douglass, for example, because he somehow didn't make it into the anthologies or the history books or the literature books. But then you discover this amazing figure wrote, and I know you've done work with the narrative of Frederick Douglass as well. But then, you know, when you talk about Edmonia Lewis, I never had heard of her until becoming aware of the opera that you were doing. And so I think increasingly you feel that way, like you've been cheated of, you know, the riches that are there. You know, so I think to uncover some of these works is really profound. I wonder if we could listen to Dreams from Edmonia. Can you set that up for us to hear?
Well, I mean, basically, Edmonia is interesting enough. When we do education, and you and I are in education as well, that's the place where we have a golden opportunity to open the doors for people, and that's the role of education. I mean, the greatest champions we have are nurses and teachers, particularly public school teachers. Mm-hmm. I mean, just amazingly is so important. And I say nurses because I had to go through a trauma in the hospital, and I had 25 nurses that helped in this 3-4 weeks that I was in coma, blah, 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 blah. And so I really have a high regard. And then I have a niece and a sister, two nieces and a sister who are nurses. So I really champion nurses. But the other thing is the public school teachers and teachers everywhere, education. That's where we can make a difference. Now, here was the first integrated and music and co-ed and racially integrated school in America was, guess what?
Oberlin.
Yeah. And she was in the first class, and she was an artist. So we have the embodiment of education, progressive arts, blah, 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 right in Oberlin, Ohio, right? And there was Edmonia Lewis. She moves to Boston, the other American citadel of American education and forward thinking, one of them. And she's there beginning her career in 1863. Come on.
That's amazing.
We're still in slavery. Yeah. Folks are still slaves in 1863. And she's being encouraged to do her art. And the great people that were there, Frederick Douglass stopped in, Winthrop, there were a whole bunch of folks that were in it. They were championing Native American rights, women's rights. They were abolitionists. I mean, these are great figures. And she was right there getting that information. And they told her, you're never going to get your message and your art across in America. We're in the middle of the Civil War. You have to go to Europe. Well, all the jazz musicians in the 1940s, 1930s had to go to Europe. But she's doing it in 1863. Come on. She goes to Europe and she finds support. But that song, Dream, is when she's in her studio and she says, you know, I really should, I can dream now to be the best that I want to be. And we all have dreams. And I think this is one of the critical pieces in the opera where she gets to talk about how she wants to grab a hold of her dreams and make them all that she wants to be. And that becomes her great art, which are these great sculptures, of course. and paintings as well, but most, well, some sketches, but mostly she became a sculptress.
Dreams, dreams, dreams and possibilities. This, this is my life. Why I'm here, I still don't know. So I stay on the search for meaning. There are things I'll always remember, memories that are ever expanding, of passion, of pain, of peace.
That's Dreams, about the 19th century sculptor Edmonia Lewis, by Bill Banfield. Bill, this may be a question that drives you nuts because it has to do with process or method, but when you were working on that, with the lyrics about dreams, the story about Edmonia Lewis, what is it that happens, and in what order does it come to you?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that. The lyrics in that is by Carolyn Maylard, who is a member of Sweet Honey in the Rock. And we wrote that song, or I wrote that song from her lyrics for another work of mine, Symphony 12. But that piece, Carolyn's lyrics and the music, it kept in my mind when I came to the process of writing. Originally, Toni Morrison commissioned this opera for me, Edmonia. When I decided after her death to finish the whole opera, the whole story, then I could take the materials about process. I had this great song called Dreams from my earlier symphony, but when I started to look at her life, when she gets to a certain place in the studio, in her studio working in alone in Italy, and she says, I want to dream about all the things that I want to do. Well, it's like, whoa, Bill, you can steal from yourself. It's legal to steal from yourself. So I took my aria from that song, from that symphony, and placed it right there for her to sing, for the character Edmonia to sing in the opera. And that's how you put these things together. For a composer who has a lot of music, he or she can really attach their own works in original new ways. And that's what happened with this particular aria. I was able to do it. And when you look at Edmonia's life, here's a young woman in her early 20s at this point, late teens, early 20s, who's working now in her 20s in Europe. And she wants to dream of herself as this great artist. So I think it really speaks to young people, whether you're an artist or whether you're a carpenter or whether you're a business person, having your dreams is really about you trying to achieve that reality. But you got to have a place to start, and it's through your dreams, your aspirations.
More on the music and ideas of Bill Banfield when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Music is tones organized to tell human stories. The one truth I've found is my music, my art, never fails me. All else falls by the wayside, but the music as truth always stands. If you serve the art, it will always serve as your truth, a bulwark against chaos.
Those are the words of Bill Banfield, my guest on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we're talking about composering, but you're also authoring. You also have written books about music and about cultural studies. Can you talk about your writing? I mean, those are beautiful words about music, tones organized to tell human stories, and music as truth that always stands. Can you tell me something about you and words, separate from the music,
yeah.
Just you and words?
Ideas and concepts and words, tones, not are things that when you write poetry and then you start writing ideas about that, they begin to all serve you musically, spiritually, aesthetically, culturally. And I think that's a lot of what music are these tones that tell and symbolize the way we live and believe in our values. And I started to think a lot more about that, I think, at the master's level as a young person. And I wanted to study philosophy and theology. And I went to Boston University to study in the same program that Martin Luther King went in, because I love systematic theology. And the systematic theology for me was the way of talking about spiritual paths in a way that allowed you to construct an ideology about how your path is going to be in a spiritual sense, but also not just spiritual, in a real lived way. And that's what theology is. It's the logos, the wisdom about living and being. And so all those things kind of sound philosophical, but they're really practical, too. That's why I talk about music as tones that tell. You know, I talk about human stories, people's stories, and that music allows us to tell that. So I think that's a little bit of where the philosophy and the reality and the poetry, and then making the move from a lyric to actually writing a song about how we live. I think that those places, that all kind of, those all live in the same place.
I want to ask you about opera, too, because I know you've written many different kinds of pieces. It could be a concerto for piano. It can be a choir. It can be a chamber, a woodwind ensemble, or, you know, many different kinds. But the opera, and you've now done how many operas?
I think Edmonia's opera 9, I think.
Okay.
8 or 9, yeah.
So the opera seems the most audacious of them in the sense that you've got the, you know, obviously the words, the whole script for the singers. You've got the orchestra. You've got costumes.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of everything.
It's everything.
And over-the-top drama.
Drama. Yeah. And dance and staging. Yeah.
Yeah. And then sometimes with opera having a reputation as being for sort of an elite group that might go to the Met and watch La Traviata. And then you're trying to make it also a popular, you know, to bring in some of the vernacular and some of the cultural studies. So can you tell me something about, for example, your opera, Luyala?
Well, we need to be on here for another 3 hours. I mean, you know, opera is very, and look, you got Omar that won the Pulitzer this year, and that's a dear friend of mine. A few years ago, and I was on the Pulitzer Prize committee that year, and we gave the Pulitzer to Anthony Davis for his opera, and there have been several other opera Pulitzer Prize winners over the years, even another one in between these years. And so opera is the big one that has all the stuff. And it's not, it just, that's the way it is. It's got dancing and singing and poetry and staging and lights and choreography. It's just a big production kind of piece. But it's popular too. And so you think of something like Hamilton, everybody's seen Hamilton, or, you know, sees it on TV or whatever, or if you've gone to see it, it will be, you know, it is... It has hip hop in it that serves the, and everybody this generation understands hip hop. So you put hip hop in an opera, and then it really becomes popular. I mean, you know, Bernstein's West Side Story is a musical, but it's still from that same idea of the art meets the common, you know, popular song. So this is a really important area of music. We've got to figure out how to make it more palatable and more affordable for everyday people to go see the opera. And then you find that it's not elitist at all. Because guess what? From a baby to an older person, everybody loves to sing. Ah, da, 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 da. This is just so natural for common people, everyday people, to sing. And opera is a sung, you know, kind of form. Mm-hmm. So I really like opera because it has, you know, let's take all the elitism stuff out of it. It's just great songs and stories, people acting and singing the story through. And the other thing about opera is, for me as a musician, the songs are fantastic, but for the composer, you know when you're going to get your legs kind of chewed up a little bit by a shark when you hear, that's Jaws, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's the psychological meaning of what music brings to the story that's exciting for composer. Yes, it's nice to write the songs. Everybody likes to sing the songs. But guess what? When you do those themes, you go, oh, we know who loves who. We don't even have to see the lovers. Because guess what? You hear the lovers' themes in the music. So I think that's the thing that makes opera fun for the composer. We get to set up the psychological meanings and the longer emotive meanings of the songs and the characters in them that's embodied in the music.
So set up a piece for us to listen to from one of your operas.
Well, let's listen to Luyala. And let's Luyala, from the excerpt that we're hearing, is about a queen, actually. It's a West African queen who falls in love with a prince from another village. And the gods and the parents set up all these parameters so they can't get to each other because they're from different kinds of villages, you know, kingdoms. But just like Romeo and Juliet, you know, the kids find each other, or West Side Story. Mm-hmm. No matter how much, the neighborhoods didn't want everybody to get together, but guess what?
They find a way.
Love will find a way, which is what, you know, what is the great, wonderful thing about love. Love will find a way. And in the opera Luyala, the princess Luyala finds her prince, her king, and this other prince who's from another village, another kingdom. And even though they're separated by miles and all kinds of things that the parents are trying to set up to keep them apart, love brings them together. So I think that's the great theme there.
Song there with beautiful instrumentation too. Tell me what's happening in the opera at that point and what character is singing this.
The character that's singing that is the mother of Luyala, who's asking the father, who's about to die, to come and die. You have done so much, and you know, she's embracing him in the death to allow him to pass away, which allows Luyala to become the queen that she's going to become, because her father is going to pass away and give her all his wisdom. So it's a very tender moment at the end of the opera. And that opera singer in that is actually Nina Freeland, who is a great jazz singer. But she sang my opera, which was done at Duke University. And you can see her styling. It's like she's got, for lack of a better word, she's like Sarah Vaughan for the older jazz folks who know Sarah Vaughan. I mean, she is our modern Sarah Vaughan, Nina Freeland. She has this beautiful, rich voice, and she sings opera as well as jazz and popular music. So she seemed like a really great choice at the time. And the tone of her voice, you know, sounds very embracing. Come and come into my arms. You know, you have to find, it's really, really cool with opera because you have to find the singer that embodies the spirit of the character. Mm-hmm. And their sound has to be a certain way. And that's not picky. It's just a good director wants a singer who embodies the spirit and of that character. And I think right there, she really captured that.
I also heard the way you weave the instrumentation, whether it's piccolo or oboe or French horn or different things, you know, so that it goes in and out from a voice to an instrument.
That's a very interesting. You know, you are something else, Emily. Yes. I think sometimes our listeners, they don't unless they've listened to a couple of times, they don't grasp that. They might hear brass, but the way in which you weave those instruments is what we in our field of composition call orchestration. You know, if you listen to Wagner, you know, or any number of great Ravel, Ellington, for that matter, you know, Frank Zappa, Maria Schneider, they are great orchestrators. They know the value of the instrument and its range, its character. So you have these different instruments, like you say, piccolo or tuba or trombone, and you can name the trombone guy or girl on your street, or the piccolo person, or the clarinet person, the witty person who speaks so quickly, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. That might be a clarinet. You know?
Right,
so
it's the personality.
Yeah, it's the personality. So composers joke around with instruments, like, you know, like if it's a kind of a tubby guy who's kind of stubborn or something, you know, you have a tuba, dum, 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 and mm-hmm. everybody laughs, but or a bassoon, because it has a kind of interesting character to the sound mm-hmm. that can evoke and be used to portray a certain individual or an emotion. So that's how I'm glad you brought that out, because I think that's part of what, when people listen to instrumental music like this, they're entertained by also those elements of the opera or the instrumental piece. Even in a jazz song, you know, you hear the trumpet with the you know, the Miles Davis kind of muted thing. It's kind of really wispy and cool. Mm-hmm. People listen to those sounds in music. I think when they listen to drum beats in, like, pop and hip-hop, they listen to certain bass drum sounds, or certain, you know, drum sounds that characterize the kind of beat it is. So I think those are kind of elements that make music interesting.
We're out of time, and we're going to go out on some music of yours. One last question, short answer. What are you the happiest about in terms of your career as a composer?
I think the happiest thing that I like, the thing that really, and this is just at the basic level, is when you make people smile. Sounds really very simple and shallow, but it's not. It's the depth of where that smile goes and the sustainability of that moment. When you know people have left a concert or an engagement that you have, where you, even if you're just playing in a band, but if you have your music played and people leave it, man, it makes them they feel good and lifted. To me, of all the things that music does for us, I think for musicians, the big thing for me as a musician is when I know people have heard my music and it lifts them in some way. It makes them smile. That's it. That's the end of the game, baby. If if people hear the music and they're enlightened, or they feel joy or happiness, or they come to connect with you through a human impulse like joy, that's a great thing.
Well, thank you for bringing joy to our hour here on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.